Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Okay, now our interview today, we are doing a true crime, and the book's called Race to Justice, and the guests are Larry Sells and Margie Porter. So let's start with Larry, because Larry, you were a prosecutor on the case, is that right?
I was. And got involved late in the game, but yes, I was.
So how did you get to where you wanted to do a book on it?
Well, I wanted to do it. It was such an important and interesting case that I wanted to do it from the outset, shortly after the trial. And I tried, but I got to admit it that I'm just not much of a writer. I can talk in the courtroom, but I have a hard time, especially writing a feature or a full-length book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just happened to run into a young lady that's a gifted writer, Margie Porter, and that's how the book got written.
Well, I think what I'm getting at is, now, in this, why this particular case? What was it about this case that made you kind of go, of all the work you've done in your life and all the cases and justice you've come across, why would you pick this case?
Well, first of all, it was connected to the Indianapolis 500-mile race. People worked there for racing teams. The victim and the person charged and convicted of the crime. That was an interesting factor. And Cindy Albrecht, in particular, the victim in this case, worked for the number one IndyCar racing team, the Marlboro Penske racing team. And she was so well known and so liked in the racing community. I mean, everybody loved the girl. She just had the type of personality that drew people to her, and such a nice, warm human being. And the vicious way that she met her death, I mean, I saw photographs, not until 4 years later, but I saw photographs of the crime scene where she was found. I couldn't imagine anybody doing that to someone, especially someone they supposedly loved. It was just horrendous. It was the most grisly photographic evidence I'd seen in a case.
Wow.
So and now, there was a fact that nobody seemed willing to do anything about it. The homicide detective on the case, Bill Jones from the Speedway Police Department, where this happened, and that's part of the Indianapolis metro area, worked his tail off gathering evidence, and he did an amazing job of not only interviewing all the possible witnesses and possible suspects, but getting documentary evidence, bank records, telephone records that were extremely important in the case. And the prosecutors, both in the county where the crime happened, here in Indianapolis, Marion County, Indiana, and where the body was found about 100 and some miles north of Indianapolis in Newton County, none of them seemed to have any interest in filing the case. They just didn't feel like there was sufficient evidence to warrant filing charges. And then they talked to me, and I don't know whether I just saw things they didn't see or had more guts than I had brains. I'm not sure of the reason, but I was convinced there was enough evidence there to file charges, and I thought that there was enough evidence to convict him.
Wow.
And so the jury ought to make that decision.
Now, Margie, I was going to say, what drew you into the case? Like, what was enticing for you to want to write this?
Well, actually, Al, when I started out, I didn't want to write this book. I was writing a different book for Larry, and I was really enthused about it. And then he comes, and he's talking about this case. And there are so many, this guy killed his wife and almost got away with it books, that I thought, you know, nobody's going to read that. But when I tried to write it and failed repeatedly, I said, let me meet her friends. And once I met her friends, I said, there's the story. But the other thing is, I was just furious about the barbarity of the savagery that this woman went through. You probably already know that she was found missing her head. And this was not some Alice in Wonderland off with her head thing. No, this was brutal what was done to this woman. And if you've looked at the back of the book, you'll know that my own mother died in an abusive marriage. So I think that anger kind of carried through, that nobody deserves to be treated this way. And people needed to know this story because it really is a strong and a powerful and a beautiful story because of the loyalty of her friends and the racing community coming together and saying, no, he's not going to get away with this. We want justice. And they tried for 6 years before Larry got this guy into court. And they were denied justice for a long time. So it really is a powerful story, and I just had to tell it once I knew the story.
Pretty incredible. So, Larry, did they sort of suspect who it was that did the murder, and did you guys kind of know but just didn't have the evidence?
Well, I wasn't involved in it. It happened October 25th, 26, 1992. I didn't get involved in the case till 4 years later when I was asked to review it. But at the time it happened, I remember reading in the paper, watching television shows about it, about the fact she was missing and who she was and how she was such a valued member of the Marble Penske racing team and everybody loved her. And I thought, well, I wonder what's happened. And then I read about the finding of the body and being identified as her. Oh, man, that's horrible. Who could have done something like that? And at the time, the husband was initially a suspect, but he had such a solid alibi, law enforcement authorities thought, that they pretty much excluded him as the person that would have done this. But I looked through all the evidence, and there were boxes of evidence, of photographs, of telephone banking records, of witness statements, I mean, everything that Bill Jones did in investigating the case. And I don't know that anybody had ever gone through all that before. And I went through it, and there were things that I saw that just pointed right at the person that did this. And then convinced my then boss to let us file the charges, and we did, and we got an extremely important piece of evidence after that. I can just basically outline the things. It won't take long, just a couple, minute or two.
Sure.
That I saw. First of all, this happened a day before their divorce was to be final. Just a couple weeks before that, they both were at the last race of the season at the Laguna Seca up near San Francisco. And he had begged her to come back to him, and she said no. They'd been separated since the May 1992 500-mile race. And all this time, he's trying to get her to come back, and she won't. She was tired of the abuse that she had suffered at his hands. And that's the thing that, you know, I looked at. I went, well, wait a minute here. She's killed just a day after the divorce, or day that the divorce is to be final, or the day before even. So what's going on here? And then I find out about her begging him, begging her to come back. And then when she's missing, he makes a trip to Florida, goes on vacation to Florida. He finds out she's missing. Of course, he knows she's missing. But he finds out she's missing. The police tell him. Everybody in the racing community, all her friends, are looking for her just constantly, 24 hours a day. They met in Indianapolis, and they're all together. They're in teams going out and looking for her, and they can't find her. While he's vacationing in Florida, this person he loved that he tried to get to come back to him just 2 weeks before, that didn't make any sense. And then her body's found, and he still doesn't seem to show much interest. One thing he did have an interest in, he continued to pay her life insurance premiums, and she didn't even know that he continued that life insurance, a $50,000 policy, and he tried to use that policy to get his boss, Antonio Ferrari, to hire some mafia type to kill her in October of 1992. He was going to use that $50,000 policy to have that done. That's all in there. And there are other things, too. He took $5,000 when she filed for a divorce, and he got the paperwork on the divorce. He gave his dad $5,000 to put in his father's bank account in Wisconsin to hide from Cindy so she wouldn't know he had the money. And he got that money out the day after she went missing. Got the money out, stuck in his pocket. He knew he didn't have to worry about that anymore because she was dead. And the condition of the body, it just showed rage. Somebody in a rage had to have cut and sawed Cindy's head off. That's not. I've been involved in something like prosecuting something like 70 murder cases. I've never seen a case where there was that much rage involved. And there was a carry-all in the room that had in Cindy's apartment that had over $2,000 in it. And it was in a Marlboro bag, and that was money that was left over from the Laguna Seca race that she was going to deposit and forward on to Marlboro Penske. Nobody knew about that money except very few people that worked in the Penske organization. And Michael Albrecht, her husband, knew about it. And that money was gone, but nothing else in the apartment was taken. And there was other money there. But that money was taken. And the alibi that he had, each time people were interviewed in regard to it as alibi witnesses, specifically Bill Filler, who's a primary alibi witness, their timelines kept changing. They tried to close in the time period within which he would have had to come to Indianapolis to commit the crime, then get back to Wisconsin. Those are things I saw right away when I looked at it, and I thought, hell, this guy did it. What are we waiting for? Let's charge him. And eventually we did, and then we get this alibi witness, Bill Filder, to flip. Hmm. After I charged him with assisting a criminal for lying about the alibi, he just decided maybe Michael wasn't that good a friend after all, and he was concerned about going to prison himself, so he said, okay, this is what happened. And that's pretty much the story in a nutshell is what happened before we filed charges.
What did the body, what did she go through? Like, what do you think happened to her?
Okay, well, I believe, and this is in part with evidence provided us by Bill Felder. But I believe that, you know, he tried to get Felder, and this is something I learned after we filed charges, but he tried to get Felder to commit the crime for him or with him. And this was early October when Felder came to Indianapolis from his home in Wisconsin. He took Felder to the site of the apartments in a wooded area where you could view the apartment. You could actually look inside it without being seen, and showed Felder where she would be. He said, now we're going to have to eventually cut her head off because she's, we don't want her immediately identified. And Felder looked at him. It had been a longtime friend of Albrecht's. They just recently renewed their acquaintance. He said, you're crazy. I'm not going to do that. And he eventually talked Felder into alibiing for him, and Felder agreed to do that. But Felder didn't know the exact time or day when he was going to do it. He just knew that Albrecht said it had to be done before the divorce became final. So Felder didn't see. He saw him on a Saturday. I think that's the 24th. He didn't see him on the 25th, but the morning of the 26th, Mike Albrecht shows up at Felder's work site, and he's driving his friend's car, and Felder sees him. He hadn't been able to get in touch with Mike on his during that period. He says, well, did you do it? Because he knew it, that he had planned to do it during that period. And Albrecht said, yes, she's in the car. You want to see her? She's in the trunk of the car. And Felder took a step toward the car, and he stopped and said, no, I don't think so. And that is a pretty dramatic moment. At least the jury thought so.
What I think made it much worse was this. It was right at the end of the race season. She was the happiest woman on the planet. She was working for Roger Penske. Now, Roger Penske is a very private man, but everything I know about him tells me that he was an excellent man to work for. His employees loved him. And she was going to go to work on his yacht, and she was so excited. Plus, she was reconnecting with her mother and going to move to Florida with a new boyfriend. She was, you know, she had literally reinvented her life. And right on the cusp of this, this creep comes up the back stairs and abducts and kills her. Now, we don't know how she died because the head was never found, okay? But, you know, if you look at all the possibilities, do you realize it takes up to 8 minutes to strangle a person? I mean, I just, I can't imagine what she went through. But anyway, she was carried, you know, back down the stairs, you know, driven 100 or so miles. Apparently, he went back to his ex-wife's house in Milwaukee to have sex with his ex-wife with her in the trunk. I mean, what kind of creature does that? But it just seemed so unfair that it was right at the moment that she was stepping into her happily ever after.
So, guys, how long did it take you to gather? I suppose this one is probably more for Larry. How long did it take the police force to gather the information that led to the conviction?
Well, I think they had all the credible evidence they needed within a year of the investigation, but no other prosecutor, they couldn't convince any other prosecutor to file a case. And Margie, go ahead.
No, carry on.
Margie has pretty much outlined what my theory was, too, that, you know, he got her in the apartment. The back door he knew would be open because she always kept it open when she'd just gotten back from that race at Laguna Seca, and she was there and taking a shower and was laying on the couch, and her cats were looking out the screen door. And he knew that that was her normal procedure. And he just went up the back stairs. She probably saw him. But she really wasn't scared of him. She should have been. She wasn't. She's probably surprised that he was there. But, he'd been trying to get her to come back to him. And she probably opened the screen door, or he opened it to talk to her. And he strangled her, carried her. He wrapped her in a comforter off the bed because that was missing. She was probably wearing just a big, large Garth Brooks T-shirt that she wore when she went to bed. That was missing. Those were the only two things that were missing from the house other than her. And he threw in the trunk, after he killed her, threw in the trunk of the car, drove back to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, because he wanted to make sure he still had that alibi timeline in play. Stayed there at his wife's house, got up in the morning, went out, saw Fielder, and then he headed back toward Indianapolis, and he stopped off at that area about halfway between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Indianapolis. As a matter of fact, it's right near a nudist colony at the Roselawn DeMott exit. And he went to this wooded area that was used to dump appliances, and he probably knew generally about that area. He took her in there in the daylight, cut her head off, wrapped her head in that comforter, maybe used a plastic bag or something as well, and put it. He laid her out there on the ground and sort of staged like some sex-crazed serial killer had committed the act, and then he left, took the head with him. We never did recover the head.
And I understand that, but I suppose the angle at which I was asking Larry is the investigation process itself, because we're hearing a lot of maybes. So maybe this happened and maybe that happened, which is what professionals, as professionals, we hypothesize those things. I understand that. But I'm just thinking in terms of the factual evidence that was before the court and how long that took to gather and how they gathered it.
Well, I indicated that Detective Bill Jones from the Speedway Police Department was the lead detective on the case. He had the assistance of the Indiana State Police, too. Bill Krueger, a detective with them, and he also had help from an FBI agent in the Milwaukee area in interviewing witnesses. But most of those interviews were all conducted, and most of that evidence was all gathered within a year's time. Bill Jones kept, after pursuing every lead he could see out there, but there wasn't much done as far as gathering additional evidence until Bill Filter agreed to cooperate, and he got involved, and that was after we'd filed the charges. But the courts made the decision that the charges, that there was a basis for the charges, went right the same day we filed them. And that was in June of 1997. June 97.
And you've asked the question, what kind of creature does this? So let's talk about that. What kind of creature does do this? What have we learned about this the killer since?
I think he was so consumed with jealousy and revenge. Those are the primary reasons, and maybe you can just lump those together, that this was done. I mean, it came to a pinnacle when she refused to come back to him, and that's what drove him over the top. But he had lost his job with a major racing team in the Indy car circuit, and he blamed her for having lost that job. Back in 1992, he was commanding a salary of nearly $75,000 as his chief mechanic. But because she and he...
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
He had a falling out, and she was going to leave him. He didn't give his attention to his job to the extent that his boss expected him to, the owner of the team. So he let him go. And Michael had nowhere to turn except to Antonio Ferrari, with whom he had worked before, And that was just a part-time job making $100 a day when he worked. And that wasn't every day. So he blamed her for that. And at the same time, she was just spiraling to the top of her profession. She was an executive chef. Penske was even going to hire her in the off-season to work on his yacht in Florida. And she was so well-respected and so looked up to in the racing community that he was jealous over that, and jealous also that after a few months of their separation, she fell in love with a fellow that she was working with, a key person in the Marlboro Penske operation, and that just ate away at him. He tried to get his brother Randy, who was a deputy sheriff in Broward County in Fort Lauderdale, to try to find somebody to rough her up, to do something to her when she came down there in the summer of 92 to visit her mother. He just was so upset with her because of what he felt she had done to him and to their marriage, and he didn't want anybody else to have her. So it was a combination of revenge and jealousy motive. And I just think his brother even describes him going bounce around from payphone to payphone to call people because he was so concerned during this period that people would know what was going on, what he was plotting, what he was planning, that he wouldn't use a regular phone. And, his brother turned him down, wouldn't do it. Antonio Ferrari turned him down and wouldn't get this hitman from the mafia. He didn't even know a hitman from the mafia, but he turned him down, and Albrecht just felt desperate and decided to do it himself.
I think, too, that her two best friends pretty much nailed what kind of creature this was, because he became very controlling of her. He demanded very dirty and disgusting sexual practices from her. He wanted her home or at work, period. He didn't want her to go shopping with her friends. He didn't want her to have any fun. He would come to her at work and say things to her to make her upset. He just absolutely wanted to control her. And I call this the world revolves around me syndrome. Anything that was not about him, he was angry about. And even the two friends were very, very cautious about anything they said in front of him. They could not say anything to imply that they'd had any fun at work, although they had a blast at work. I mean, they were dancing and singing and coming up with comedy routines. These three girls were having a wonderful, wonderful time, but they couldn't even say it in front of him because he would get mad. And they didn't even know what Mad looked like, except that he had quite a reputation for being abusive even to the men he worked with.
I understand that. I think the I guess what I'm thinking is that people aren't born killers. And so is there a possibility that he and this comment is probably going to create outcry from our audience, but I have to ask the question because we know that our early experiences shape our later life and our coping mechanisms and our ability to emotionally regulate. So what happened, or what do we know about his early life that led him to be that person that he grew into?
Actually, nothing. He seemed to come from a really great family. I mean, you know, he had three brothers and a sister, and he was, you know, the older brother that the little sister looked up to. I didn't see anything in his background as far as, you know, violence or mistreatment or anything. They were just a nice family, the middle class, you know, hardworking dad, had a cabin that they vacationed at, and I don't see anything that would make him a killer other than it just all had to be his way, and I don't think it was early environment at all. I think it was the decisions that he made as an adult.
Okay. In terms of our understanding of his early life, has that been explored with his brother and sister, or are we looking at from the outside looking in and trying to come up with?
We're just looking at the evidence of, you know, what we see from the family, and of course it is after the fact, but no, we have not interviewed the brothers and sisters about this, except that in court, of course, his sister said that, you know, he was the good brother and the protective brother, and the brothers actually were, you know, putting together a musical group, and as far as anyone could tell, it was a good, tight-knit family.
And his ex-wife loved him. She wanted him back, even though they got divorced and he married Cindy. And they had three daughters that worshiped their dad. And Cindy spent a lot of time with those daughters during the period that Michael and Cindy were married. And the daughters got close to Cindy as well. But they worshiped their father. And there wasn't any indication of any aberrant behavior until you know, right around the time of the May 1992 500 and shortly before. Cindy had been the victim of a spousal abuse in Florida that resulted in her getting a divorce, and it was about that time that she met Michael down in Florida, and they got together and ended up getting married. But there's no indication of any abusive type behavior before the spring of 1992.
So now the best friend that covered for him, where did he stand in this? Like, so you think that he just knew about it and served as an alibi, but didn't partake in any of the killing? And what happened to him?
Well, he idolized Michael Albrecht because Michael was a big man in the IndyCar racing community, being a chief mechanic, and they'd known each other when they were younger. They hadn't spent much time together for years, but then they reconnected before the May 1992 500, and he just looked up to Michael, and he, you know, he was willing to do just about anything for him except kill for him, and he said that he didn't think that Michael was really serious about doing it. And he agreed to alibi for him, and he even said after that something happened to Cindy that he wasn't certain that Michael had done what had happened to her about her being killed and having her head removed. He just didn't think Michael was capable of that. But then after we talked to him, he became pretty well convinced that yes, Michael had done it. At least I'm indicating what he said on a couple of television shows. I can't say that exactly what his feelings were. I do know if he'd had the guts or the moral fiber to come forward when Michael first talked to him about what he wanted to do to Cindy and try to get him involved in it, that Cindy Albrecht would still be alive today. And Filler's going to have to take that to his grave.
Yeah, yeah. Did he end up getting any jail time, or is he just he got off for just testifying?
Well, you know, he was arrested for the offense of assisting a criminal for lying about the alibi after Michael committed the crime. We couldn't prove any direct evidence between him and the actual commission of the crime of murder, Cindy's murder. But we, in order to get a statement and cooperation for him, had to give him a grant of what's called use immunity, meaning anything he told us, as long as it was the truth, could not be used in any court proceeding against him. So everything he told us was off limits, as long as we believed him. When he finished talking to us and we compared to what he said to what evidence we already knew existed, we were convinced he was telling the truth. So we couldn't use that statement he gave us nor his testimony in court. So we were left with the evidence then that we had initially against Michael Albrecht, being able to use that. And part of that evidence was provided by Michael Albrecht. And we weren't going to call him to testify against Bill Filder. So we were in a position of having a case that we couldn't prosecute. And I knew that going in, that was a very likely possibility. But still, I felt like Bill Filder had committed that crime, and I thought maybe he might be willing, with a little encouragement, to tell us what he knew, which he did, and I'm grateful for that. But I ended up dismissing the case against him, not because I was grateful, but because we had no case we could really prosecute it against him. We actually had a flimsy connection. There was enough evidence, but it wasn't overwhelming as to even jurisdiction over Bill Filder, because nearly everything he did was in Wisconsin, and the crime was committed in Indiana. There were some things connected him to the actual commission of the crime, contact with Albrecht and about the alibi and stuff after the crime was committed. But again, we had no case we could prosecute him on after he testified, cooperated.
And when this was shown on Paula's On, I think it's very telling that right at the end, Filder said, you know, that if he had called her, if he had done something, she would still be alive. And he confessed that guilt on the show.
Hmm. So Margie, what do you hope people get from reading this book?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of a successful book. I mean, naturally, we think, you know, it would be great if thousands of people read it. But my definition of success for this book is this. If, say, 100 readers read this book and they're inspired by Cindy's life because she brought herself up from the slums to work for Penske, which is the pinnacle in the racing community, in case you're not aware. She brought herself up. And then she had friends who just had heart and soul devotion to her. And Larry just energetically and tirelessly battled in court against literally tigers. And if 100 people read this book and were inspired by it and then looked in the mirror and said, you know, I want to be a person who makes a difference too, this would be a successful book. Just 100 people who were inspired by it.
And how long did it take you to put this book together?
The first draft took about 8 months, but it was over 600 pages. So the draft I turned in, I think, was number 11.
Yeah. Did you know about the racing world before the book, or is this sort of a new kind of part of the world that you were unaware of?
No, I did not know about the racing world. I basically had to get a full education. And it started when Larry brought me 5 banker's boxes full of files. And I was intimidated at first, but then I thought, well, you know, if he could read all this, I can too. So, and once I'd met Cindy's friends, I was just determined to tell this story no matter what it took. So there just wasn't going to, nobody was going to stop me from writing this book after that.
And so at the end of the day, how did her friends feel about the case, and did they kind of know right from the beginning who did it, or was this a surprise?
Oh, they felt like they did, and one of the things you'll read in the book is how they tormented him. In fact, a great many people in the racing community were in on it just to make sure he never thought that he had gotten away with it. So they played some really great practical jokes on him. One was Sandy Fink called his job where he was having a wonderful time working on BMWs and said, I'm from the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and we just want to confirm that Michael works there because, well, you know, he's a person of interest in his wife's death, and so we're trying to keep an eye on him. I don't think he kept the job much after that. But they did things just to torment him and let him know that he hadn't gotten away with it. You know, I love that they just would not be defeated. So yes, maybe they knew, but even when the case was in the newspapers, people were saying, no, the prosecution can't win this one. No, they're not going to win. And Larry was just in there, you know, fighting to the finish, and even he didn't know till the end if he would get a conviction. But, you know, it was a tiger fight, because if you read the background of the attorneys he was against, I mean, this was David and Goliath for sure.
Wow, where did he get such good attorneys?
Well, the state paid for them, of course. You know, he's the poor pitiful, you know, he's the poor pitiful villain. So the state buys him the very best, and the prosecutors work for a salary and put in as many hours or more than the defending attorneys do. But yeah, he got great attorneys.
Well, he had an attorney who later represented terrorists at Guantanamo at federal expense. But he also had the money left from that life insurance policy, believe it or not. He cashed that in. He filed for a claim against it in March of 1993, and at that time, there was no objection in federal court. They'd filed a declaratory judgment act there to get the money, and he got that $50,000 plus interest on that. His family had to spend a lot of money as well. The attorney that he started with was an attorney in the Atlanta, Georgia area that represented him on the extradition proceedings down there. He ended up carrying on his lawyer in Indianapolis as well as with this other attorney. He had a top-notch legal team, and I know that the family had to pay out a lot of money. And, of course, a lot of money was paid out afterwards to handle his appeals and stuff at public expense. But the money was not an issue.
Hmm. So he was able to claim that insurance policy even though he did what he did.
Yeah, well, he hadn't been charged. He wasn't charged till years after that, and no one challenged. The insurance company wanted to challenge paying it, but they didn't have any base to do it, they didn't think. If they'd have waited until, June of 1997, they probably wouldn't have had to pay it out.
I wonder if they can get it back.
Well, good luck there. It doesn't exist anymore, and he's in prison.
Yeah, and so now he got, what, 60 years? He's eligible for parole coming up not too far, is it? Like 4 years or something?
Yeah. You know how it worked in Indiana at the time?
Yeah.
He received the maximum sentence for murder other than the death penalty and life without parole that a criminal defendant could receive at that time. He had 60 years. In Indiana at that time, that meant you only had to serve half the sentence, plus, as long as you behaved yourself in prison, plus you got educational credits. He took college courses at taxpayer expense,
and received an additional four-year reduction of his sentence. So he ended up after with a 60-year sentence, actually serving or will have served 26 years. Hmm. The law has since changed in Indiana, effective 2014. A person convicted of a crime such as that has to serve at least 75% of their sentence. But that wasn't the case back then.
Wow, that's just amazing. Now, do you have a website or anything that people, if they want to reach you or maybe pass on information or find out more about you? And we'll start with Larry.
Well, one way that they can obtain information about us is through the Amazon author site. They can look up us. If you look up Larry Sells, you might end up finding some guy, I think, in Iowa that writes horror stories. Well, that's not me. I'm the prosecutor in Indianapolis. But if you look up the author section, there's some information in there, and there'll be considerably more. Plus, if you buy the book, there's information in there about us as well. There are blogs that have been written primarily by Margie, and she can tell you about those. But there's information in there, and I'm going to put in my author section of the Amazon book site. More information about me personally, some background information.
Great. And Margie, do you have a website, author page?
I do not. I have the author page, and I'm on Facebook.
Heck, I'm not even on Facebook.
Yeah.
But Margie can tell you I've led a pretty colorful life. There isn't much I haven't done over the years, and I'm going to include that in whatever information I can get out there.
Yeah, he's a character for sure. Larry grew up in the Dale Hollow area of Tennessee with grandfathers who were great storytellers, and it shows up in court. If you saw the True Conviction episode, that's just how he is. He is such a character. And when he gets into court, people are just mesmerized. The first time we walked through court right before the Paula Zahn episode, all these people, strangers to me, but people who had not seen him for years and years and years, were coming up to him going, "Marlboro Man," you know, because he had such a reputation. He's a character.
Wow. Well, we have to look forward to seeing that. And now the book, of course, is available at Amazon or Wild Blue Press or probably any fine bookstore. We will have that linked up on our webpage, so people listening through the site or if they go to the station page, they can just do one click and pick up the book. We recommend it. Again, the book is called Race to Justice, and the guests have been the authors Larry Sells and Margie Porter. Thank you for telling us about your book and story.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Al, Julie.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.